Right. So this is the 9/11 Truth and Other Deep State Crimes teleconference for the 28th of December 2016. Ken Freeland and Cheryl Curtis facilitating. Craig McKee, Secretary. Craig, would you like to call the roll?
I'll read. I've got the names here. Already, so I'll read them off, and if I'm missing anybody, you can let me know. I have Cheryl Curtis, myself, Dwayne Dietz, Frank Tlopko, James Hufford, Ken Freeland, Mike Cook, Nita Renfrew, David Rold, and is it Patrick O'Connell? Is that the other person?
It's Pat O'Connell and Stuart Nelson in Texas.
Oh, okay, Pat O'Connell. Let me just get this. And Stuart spelled how again?
S-T-U-A-R-T, Nelson.
Nelson. And I want to ask everybody, while I have a chance, I want to really update, you know, when I put in out the minutes, I put the group affiliation, if there is one, or any affiliation that people would like to list beside their name. So maybe I could just... check with people. I think I, you know, I know Cheryl and Ken, and I know James is 9/11 Grassroots, and I know Dwayne is San Diego 9/11 Truth, and but Nita, for instance, is there one that you would like to be linked with in the minutes? Like a group, or just?
I'm in New York, but I'm not really with New York's 9/11 Truth.
Okay, so we'll just put
I'm on
New
my
York.
Own
we'll
here. Put, I'm with 9/11, but on my own.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah, that's fine.
That makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure there are a few people that are, yeah, not part of groups. Yeah. What about Pat and Stuart? Do you have a particular group, or are you just...
We're with 9/11 TAP. We're the regional coordinators for Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Louisiana.
Okay, great. Great. And who else am I missing? Frank, what? How do you want to be
Berkshire,
listed?
Berkshire 9/11 Truth.
Berkshire 9/11 Truth, right. I'm sure that's the same one I've always had for you, but I just want to...
Yeah.
I think there might be a few things that have gotten out of date, and I'd like to fix them up. Okay, so I guess we're good. Oh, and Xander, how do you want to be listed?
Hey there. ASU 9/11 Studies.
Did you say ASU?
Yeah, Arizona State University.
Go.
9/11 Studies. Okay.
Yep.
This is Nita. You could put New York 9/11 Truth. Yeah. Because that's not
okay.
A group. That's just me. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
You're the whole city to yourself. Wow.
So anybody else from New York will have to get their own name now. This one's taken.
Okay, then, are we ready to roll?
So yep. This is, I didn't hear my name. This is Wayne Costi.
Oh, I didn't see you on the list. Yeah.
I joined a few minutes
okay.
late.
Yeah, okay. Got you, Wayne. So I think I have everybody read out now.
All right, then. The first item on our agenda, as always, is to approve the minutes from the previous meeting as circulated by Craig. Any objections to that? And then hearing on the minutes.
Oh, David.
Ken, I think David is was not listed last time. David rolled. I got your email, David. Thank you.
Yeah,
sorry about missing you. I'll get you in.
There were actually, like, I think eight of us on the call from Jane Milliken's speakerphone from Boston 9/11.
Yeah, I forwarded you the list. I did forward you that list, Craig, for the record.
Oh.
So you should have it. Okay.
Oh.
So maybe
okay.
Yeah, maybe just amend those minutes and then send them back to me. Okay.
Yes. Yes, I definitely will. Okay. Sure.
Okay. All right. Anything else? Anybody other amendments of the minutes? Okay, then hearing none, then with that amendment, we'll take the minutes for approved and move on to tonight's draft agenda. Any objections to adopting the draft agenda for tonight's use? Any other additions or deletions? Okay, hearing none, then I guess we're set to go. And let's see, we're going to proceed then first with our featured speaker this evening. And as James Hufford did some of the took some of the initiative in inviting Dr. Cutworth to join us, he will give us the formal introduction. So go ahead, James.
Okay, well, from information I have anyway, I haven't met Dr. Cutworth, but information I have is that Dr. Ronald Cutworth holds a PhD in Management of Engineering Science Operations. Is that from University of Illinois?
No.
Ron?
Walden University.
Oh, okay. All right. His PhD dissertation includes an evaluation of over 200 engineering science research operations at Lawrence Livermore National Lab. I think we've heard of that. He's an engineering scientist holding advanced level lower degree credits in five categories of engineering sciences and advanced theoretical math, mechanical, electrical, electronic manufacturing, and controls engineering. Pretty impressive. He also holds 9 issued patents for Lawrence Livermore National Labs in development of laser optic mount and apparatus hardware. He has his own publishing company, which I guess makes it pretty easy to get his own material published. The reason that he's speaking to us tonight is that he has, or says that he has discovered a second explosive agent that, along with nanothermite, was used in bringing down the World Trade Center, so we're gonna find out about that and maybe put him to the test, ask him what questions we may have about it. So, Dr. Cutworth, it's all yours.
Okay, before we get started, Dr. Cutworth, we need to put this into lecture mode so there won't be any background noise. So give us just a second here, and we need to make sure that we unmute you. Okay,
hello?
Dr. Cutworth, you should be able to speak now, and the rest of us are mute, or the rest of the callers are muted. So please proceed. Thank you.
All right, I started with the AE 911. I'm not officially with them, but I am a member. After I saw the World Trade Center 7 come down straight down, I knew it was controlled demolition, and so I hunted around on them, and also I understood that they were people like Steve Jones were struggling with Livermore Lab trying to get information on nanothermite, and that it had cut to steel, and that is true. Now I did some research at Livermore Lab, and of course, since I evaluated their operations, it was easier for me to get some information, and found there was simultaneous research on nanothermite and nano-RDX. Nano-RDX comes from RDX, which was used in World War II, but nano-RDX is about 10 times stronger. It's almost the strength of a nuclear weapon. And that's what fooled people. They thought, oh, gee, was that a nuclear weapon? No, but and it can't be a nuclear weapon because nuclear weapons explode in round balls, and this had to be, this is square buildings and all square, and so they had to load it up. Now, how they brought the steel columns down, the core columns, was with the nanothermite. The core columns were extremely strong. The building weighs about 300 million pounds. But to hold that up, they have to have 4 times that strength, which becomes more like a billion-pound strength. And at the bottom, characteristic steel is 5-foot by 3-foot square by 5-inch thick steel. which is about 960 square inches, which will hold up 44 million pounds. That was just one. There were 48 of those. And then as you go up the building, it requires less, so it's still four times the strength. And now the beautiful thing about World Trade Center 1 is the reason I picked it. It's perfect. They made a terrible mistake on how they crashed a plane into it. It hit in the center of the building and also on the center of the concrete floor, 96 concrete floor. It hit right in the center of that with the front of the plane. So that split the plane in half is what I figured out. I'll explain that more a little bit later. But anyway, let's talk about the strength of the floors. What I'm examining predominantly is what destroyed the floors. Can we prove it's explosives? Yes. Each floor has claimed to be about 1,000 tons or 2 million pounds. And now each floor has the strength in the concrete of 2,500 pounds per square inch. If you calculate all of those square inches for the whole floor, it's more than a trillion pounds of stiffness. I couldn't hold up a trillion pounds on the floor, but it's that stiffness. Now, if you had one of those sitting down at the bottom and you stacked all the other floors on top of it, it would not crush because it's that stiff. And not only that, the floors are stronger than any building ever built. They had special trusses built that were designed to take an impact from an airplane. They are built in a checkerboard pattern. So they, you hit from any direction. And they were not only that, they were doubled up with really heavy steel. They two going one direction and two going the other direction and welded all together so that it was a good pattern, a very stiff, good pattern. Okay, so the floor stiffness is partly due to that. Okay, now what would it take? All right, now since one floor is 2 million pounds, somebody said that, they all fell. Well, all those trusses have steel, and they're about 18 inches deep, and so it's a steel frame, and if the floor fell, it would hit on another floor on top of its steel trusses and not hit any of the concrete in the center. So there's no impact on concrete except for where the trusses are, so it could not possibly damage the concrete from fall. So that's all was the story of NIST, and everybody's struggling with NIST trying to get them to admit. So I'm just saying, well, why bother with that? We'll just go straight for a criminal investigation by the FBI. We need to have the forensic analysis is what I did, and with that I can prove the floors were demolished, had to be demolished by explosives, therefore this is treason. So if the FBI doesn't go along with it, I can go into federal court. That's my plan, and I will go in there with registered professional information. Anyway, now we get to the floor. What would it take to pulverize? You notice in those videos, all the floors were turned into total powder. And Steve Jones says it was about 3 to 6 microns. It was almost like face powder turned into all floors. And there was nothing left on the bottom. And also all of the steel on the trusses was all turned into tiny pieces. And that's proven because there's no trusses, no pieces of trusses on the ground. So, but they found, people looked around and they found these real tiny pieces of steel that were from the floor plate and from the truss parts. So those were all turned into tiny pieces. Now, of course, when the floor is built that way, and the floor has stiffness of a trillion pounds, an aircraft couldn't do much damage to that, see? So, anyway, now we get to examine how did they, when you do a controlled demolition, you notice how they do that. They blow it down, you see powder, and some of the powdered concrete, and they collapse, and then they take out all the floors and break them up into littler pieces and then take them to rock yards where they grind them up. So we can use that. That is a straightforward analysis means to determine how much would it take to turn these floors into powder. All right, so I found a concrete grinding machine that will grind up 1,000 tons of concrete in 1 hour. And that's, of course, happens to be the weight of those floors. And that would be without the steel in it. Now, they'd have to, it'd be another machine that would have to take the steel out of it. But for now, just for this round numbers, one machine can grind up one floor in 1 hour. But that's not into powder. That makes it into small pieces, small rocks. So they'd have to take another setting and turn that into powder. So it takes two machines in tandem to turn one floor into powder in 1 hour. Of course, you know, all the floors came down in 14 seconds. So what would it take? Let's see. So if you wanted to count, well, let's see how many it would take to do it all in 1 minute. Well, then you'd have to multiply the 2 times 60 machines, and that'd be 120 machines running that. And they're about 500 horsepower motors, and one horsepower is equal to 500 foot-pounds. So one machine is worth, it distributes 25,000 foot-pounds of force. So anyway, you get, so it'd take 120 of those to get the floor ground up in 1 minute. Only that, we know, is still too slow. So to get it into 15 seconds would be 4 times that amount, which becomes 480 concrete grinding machines. And you can follow the, if you want to do all, you know, this is all can be done with high school math. You just have to watch it on the zeros, and you recorded this, so you can go look back and do it yourself. I'd like to see somebody report back to me. They did it themselves. If you did, I'd give them a certificate. But it'd be, so anyway, 480 concrete grinding machines of 1,000 ton capacity, and to grind up one floor in 15 seconds. That's, of course, not fast enough. And then when we look at the, okay, so if you have 480 machines and multiply that times 110 floors, that becomes 52,800 concrete grinding machines at 25,000 foot-pounds of force in each one, which becomes 1,320 pounds of foot-pounds of force to grind up all of the floors in 14 seconds. Now, there's more to that. If you notice those videos where the David Chandler said those things were flying out at 70 miles an hour, and then you notice how they blew up. They blew up. There was even though there's one right after another, there was still a pause between each one. So the floor, each floor blew up faster, actually, than 1 second. So that means our calculation for 14 seconds was 540 machines. So it'd be more than 10 times that amount. So it'd be, you see what I'm saying? That would be then 10 trillion pounds to all the floors. So it's obvious then that the floors had to be demolished by explosives. Now, what explosives can do that? We'd have, there's another issue on that. We'll go back to the plane. The floors are 2,500 pounds per square inch, and if you calculate also, the plane hit the edge of that floor. Well, if you calculate what did that floor hit, and the concrete is 5 inches thick, the concrete strength is the same on the top and then the same on the side. So if it's hit on the side and the plane is 19 feet wide, that would be like a big axe slicing the plane. Let's see. So if you calculate the numbers of inches, that's it becomes 2,850,000 pounds of concrete and steel that airplane hit. That's why I say, you know, they say, oh, it went at 500 miles an hour. Well, oh, that's another error they made in all these estimates. Everybody around the country did estimates. The builders of the building said, we designed it to take the impact of the biggest airplane at the time, which would be 350,000 pounds. So everybody calculates that airplane as though it's 350,000 pound steel hammer. It's not. It's a flimsy aircraft. And not only that, reports are it had no fuel in the wings, it had no cargo, and I believe it was a fuel tanker, and that's why I picked World Trade Center 1. It was Air Force fuel tanker. So it probably had some more titanium in it, so it was stronger, but it certainly would be no. But anyway, that cuts the weight right in half to about 150,000 pounds, and then it would get sliced in half. It's not a match at all. And only that since, now, another thing they picked the wrong side to hit. It's more distant. The core columns are set up in a triangle, not a triangle, in a rectangle. So it was 60 feet of floor that the aircraft had to go through to get to the core columns. So you see it tore that plane in half. Up to 60 feet, so it did not reach the core columns. So, you know, the claim was, oh, they knocked down, 15, 20 core columns. Not a chance. It could not have done that. And even if some of the pieces of parts of the plane got to it, it could be no match for the strength of those core columns. So that's a fantasy generated by the government and other people. And now we get to the balance of the, now, what explosives can destroy that floor? And I had worked at Livermore Lab, and I'm familiar with their patenting, and I have patents with them. So I went back and searched there, and I know they have a great big explosives lab, and I'm familiar with that. I went back and found the report that nobody else could find. I got it anyway, that said that they had done the fundamental research on nano-RDX and nanothermite simultaneously, and others. And now we get to, since it takes, it equals trillions of pounds of foot-pounds of force to demolish the concrete, then it had to be strong explosives. And nano-RDX is 10 times the older World War II RDX. And not only that, it would not take as many tons to install and much easier to install. So it was just the ideal thing. Now, we don't have to prove that it is nano-RDX, but the strength shows it was some kind of an explosive like that. Now there is kind of proof that there was nano-RDX, because there is in the reports on nano-RDX. Hello? Are you there? Hello? 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 Hello?
Yes, we're all here, Dr.
Oh, okay, okay. And
everyone else
sure
is, everyone else is muted. Yeah, everyone else is muted so that there won't be any background noise, okay?
Okay. The evidence that there is nano-RDX is that the nanothermite was scattered, unexploded nanothermite was scattered all over the area, 600 feet in all directions. It's scattered everywhere. Why would there be unexploded nanothermite anyway? That's because in the studies on nanothermite mixed with nano-RDX, not all of it explodes. So not all of the nano-RDX explodes. So it's that's a symptom. And another symptom is, I asked them once I found the nano-RDX, I said, look around. Richard Gage had samples, and I said, look around, see if you find samples in any of your samples you have, any residue. No, there's no residue. And that is a symptom it was nano-RDX, because nano-RDX is strictly nitrogen. It would turn totally back into nitrogen. It's only nitrogen. And it also, that it's nitrogen, in small molecules makes it so that it packs more dense, and it's the density that makes the strength. So in a way, that's multiple symptoms that it was a mix of nano-RDX and the other. Okay, so that's the summary. Any questions? Hello? Hello? Hello?
Okay. If that's the your presentation, then we're going to go into Q&A mode so others can ask questions. It'll just take a second. Perhaps while we're doing that, I'd like to ask you, Doctor, if there's any kind of markers that could be found if the tests were examined that would be positive evidence of the use of RDX.
Use of what? Oh, well,
like
I said, the marker is there was no residue found. And there is the marker of unexploded nano-RDX, and the reports show that when nano-RDX is mixed with nanothermite, somehow the nanothermite does not all explode. So that would explain why there would be, it could be nano-RDX mixed with nanothermite. Because why would it be so much around of not unexploded?
Mm-hmm.
Now, another issue is how did they load those columns? Actually, this is nano-RDX. I mean, nanothermite could be poured when they mix it. It's like wood, they can pour it into a mold. So they pre-manufactured mold and put the detonators in them as they built them. And those were exactly designed to fit inside the core columns. The core columns at every floor have big openings in the wall so they could reach in and tighten bolts. So it just was perfect. So they could, every floor that they wanted, they didn't at every floor, every other floor. And all they had to do was load a, they had control of all the elevators. That was the elevator people that I believe did that. They had an elevator contract. And they what they do is put a bunch of shaped charges on the top of an elevator. Somebody pushed the button, move them up to the next floor, and they install those in a few seconds and go and then push a button up to the next floor. So it was easy. It only took a matter of a few weeks to get all the floors in both buildings loaded.
Okay, we're going to go into Q&A mode, so this will just take a second here. And in order to ask a question, once we're in a Q&A mode, you just press *6. It will put your number into an automatic queue. So,
what's that?
Okay, so *6, if you'd like to be in the queue to ask a question, *6. And we'll go to the first questioner. Sorry about that. That wasn't clear. Okay, we'll try it again here. I'm going to have to unmute Dr. Cutworth again. Okay, so I'm sorry, *6, if you'd like to be in the queue to ask a question. *6.
Nobody's asking questions, right?
Yeah, I know. We're having a little trouble getting it started here, but there were some people that wanted to ask questions. So, okay. Go ahead, Michael.
Hey, thanks a lot. Yeah, appreciate you coming on, Doctor. I volunteer with architects and engineers. I don't have any kind of advanced degrees or anything like that. I'm a construction worker.
Yeah.
I've been in the business like 35 years, in the union close to 20, and I was on a great big Intel computer chip factory that poured 100,000 yards of concrete and,
yeah,
you know, things like that. So yeah, I'm one of those people that knew on day one that it was blown up, and I appreciate you coming in. I've been hearing rumor of this nano-RDX for a while. I'm disappointed that we're probably not going to find any telltale signs in the dust, unless it would be
it's a point, but in a way that's good news, because other explosives would leave residue.
Right.
This nano RDX left no residue, so that's a good sign that it was nano RDX. And another sign is that since the nanothermite is found everywhere, unexploded nanothermite, that's another telltale sign that it was nano RDX, because that is what happens. Much of the good percent of the nanothermite does not explode. So that would be, now in the core columns, it would all explode because it's all by itself, all new mix. But when they mix them together, I believe that it is nano RDX is just a little faster. It goes off in 2 nanoseconds and travels at 10,000 miles an hour. And nanothermite is fast, but not exactly that fast. You know, half a nanosecond makes a difference. Okay?
Oh, yeah. Would there be an abundance of nitrogen? You said it's primarily nitrogen. And would an abnormal amount of nitrogen, do you think?
No, because when it all turns into gas, it goes north.
Okay, it turns into
No, it would be disappear if you go up north, and that was when the floors are blown up in less than 2 nanoseconds, and they saw the floors flew up and out.
Yeah,
along with that went the gas. Huh?
Would it be something you could develop into a spray-on sol gel like the nanothermite with it?
How nano RDX is made is by mixing with it's a sol gel, it's called. It's a solvent. They mix the nano RDX, the RDX in it, and it dissolves it. And then they dry the solvent away.
And does it have a really high ignition temperature like the thermite?
No. Thermite is developed originally as a thermal explosive that could cut holes in ships for rescue. So it would not do collateral damage everywhere. It just quickly cut a hole, and that's extremely high temperatures. But they all have high temperatures, but not like thermite is cold thermite because it cuts steel.
Yeah, the ignition temperature is what I was particularly interested in, because the ignition temperature.
Well, if you want to do research on it, you can look up. Don't look up explosives. Look up energetic materials. Because energetic materials is the new science where it's really, it detonates. It doesn't really explode. It detonates, and they have all kinds of theories about how does it detonate, and they put it on the computers and all, but it detonates. It's not really an explosive. Well, it's an explosive, but when you want to look that up, you look up on energetic materials, and there's several textbooks out there. Hunt for those.
Yeah. You say there's patents and probably documented in the literature that this stuff exists, commercially available to the right people?
That's the thing. It's hard to get nano RDX. In fact, the Livermore Labs patents are still classified. You cannot get their patents or their specific design now. Those are still classified.
Great. Thank you.
Huh?
Yeah, Ed, thank you very much. It's very interesting information. I don't know if it's going to be a lot of use to us, but it's nice to know what's going on.
Oh, yes.
Okay, let's go to the next questioner, Xander Rayner.
Hello, Xander? Dr. Cutberg.
Hello.
Xander Rayner?
Yes, hello? I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're breaking up pretty bad, Xander.
Okay, Dr. Cutberg. The question is, what specifically makes nano RDX nano? RDX
is
a molecular...
Is, Yeah, well, nano
it is a molecule, and it reacts at the molecular level inherently. So all RDX.
Let me answer you.
Yeah.
It is that nano is because it is it's compressed into a smaller area. That is just how it got the name of nano. You have explosives, but then when it's nano, it's been packed into a much smaller area in nano dimensions. It's still the same molecule, but they're closer together. So it makes the density of the explosive 10 times stronger in the case of RDX.
Sir, I'm very glad to hear you say that. That was the only acceptable answer. It adds a lot to your credibility. Thank you. I'm curious, do you think that this RDX also had fine-grain aluminum or other sorts of metal fuels combined with it? Or was it only just a tighter?
Nanothermite would have different things. They have metals. Nanothermite has metals in it, iron and aluminum, and they found those in the scientific analysis. But
there's no thermobaric component to this RDX, then,
nothing
correct?
To RDX, nothing. It is, and that's the advantage to make it so that it is stronger when you, in fact, see, when you, if you were to mix things with it, that makes the molecule bigger so it wouldn't compress as much or that it's packed as closely. See?
Okay. Sir, one final question, because you may have some expertise in the other realm that regarding the nanothermite. Would those chips, the chips that have found, have had some sort of percussion blast wave based on the superheating of the gases and the binder molecules? Would they have had an explosive force sufficient to, for example, rupture?
Well, they do explode. There is a percussion, or what do you want to call it, but it's not as much. Its function is to burn. So, in fact, you see, that was the original design. They wanted to cut holes in ship's hulls without having collateral damage from an explosive that has a big blast. See, the blast on it is very small compared to the burning. See what I mean?
Yeah. I suppose I'm asking another here. With respect to the sequential explosions, the progressive explosions that we see are running down, for example, the axis of Tower 1, we don't hear the high crack of a typical high explosive. So then the audible difference, is that related to the speed of the pressure wave, or is it just the smaller size of the charges?
No, they were big charges because on nano RDX particularly, there were huge charges in terms of its strength, but they were not big in the amount of the square inch area or whatever. But they were. But now, what I could see happen, why we didn't hear the explosions from since it had the punch of trillions of pounds for each floor, why didn't we hear the noise? That's it's a good question. We didn't because it was busy pushing the concrete up and out. So the concrete powder absorbed the sound.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Isn't that interesting? We would think that would be a bunch of huge, huge explosion, but what we heard was the other explosives they used for other special cases, and we heard the detonators go off, and that's what you see blasting out the windows is detonators of the explosives. See? And we heard those. Those are on record, but not the big bang that you'd think, you know? That's a good question.
Great. Okay. Is that it, Sanders?
Yeah, that's it. Thank you very much.
Okay. Are you welcome? And Wayne Costi, you're next.
Yes. Hello, Ronald. This is Wayne Costi. I've got, two questions for you, one's an observation. You had made the comment that there were tiny pieces of steel. It's indicating that they had been broken up into small pieces. But my observations from looking at the literature, the photographs, is that there's acres and acres of of bent and twisted steel, small steel that would have made up the floor trusses, things like that. And
I looked at all the photos available, and there were no floor truss steel. You would see the wavy lines from them, but you did see the.
I would just direct you to look at FEMA Appendix D as a place to begin. You can see the acres of, you know, you're not going to see it right in the footprint, but as they dug through it and they sifted and moved things around, there's acres of this steel trash, not the big columns, but the much smaller stuff. And FEMA Appendix D is one of the places where you'll see some of that. That's just
well, you have well, no, there is a fact that the and this is something I didn't explain, is the reason the fuel from the plane blew straight out from the building. As soon as the plane went in, the fuel blew out. Why did it blow out? Because surrounding the core columns was a heavy firewall, the 7-inch thick firewall, supported by steel structure. Those would be a lot smaller steel pieces. And also around the elevators, there were smaller pieces of steel and in other framings. So that would not be. I'll look at that Appendix D, but I've seen no, and there would be no reason for there to be any pieces left, because when the floor concrete, it was one of the things we didn't cover is the analysis of the floor steel pan that the concrete sits on. To pulverize the concrete, to turn it into powder, it had to tear the steel pan into tiny pieces. And to do that so that it would pulverize, the trusses would also pulverize. So I'll have to look at that Appendix D, but I've seen no photos that say, these are trusses. My goodness, these are trusses. I don't think so. But there is stuff, structural members holding up the walls in there.
Well, yes, certainly there are. So my second question relates to the plane impact into the side of the building. As you know, there's a lot of discussion about could a plane break through the outer steel column, perimeter column.
I didn't go into great detail.
Can I ask a question?
Go ahead.
So my observation from looking at a number of the photos is that the steel perimeter columns weren't, in fact, sliced like a tree would have been, but instead it was bent up, broken. It appears like they may have been broken at the joints and bent. And I'd like
broken
to get
in,
a comment on that. So. Thanks. Over.
Well, the pictures do show that those outer columns were broken in, yes. But that shows it was hit. Now, for the people who say there was no plane that hit it, that shows a plane did hit it. It has that shape. But those outer columns were not as strong as the inner core columns. And also there's another fact that – oh, no, what was the question again?
Just whether or not a plane could actually sever the columns, or whether they were just simply broken at the welds potentially and bent.
Well, no. See, that was the point of my. Oh, another issue that I didn't cover is the plane hit the floor on the 96th floor right in the center of the fuselage, and that was it. Hit 2,850,000 pounds steel supported floor with rebar and with truss supported. So it split the plane in half. So it had no strength. In fact, when it being split in half, it would be continuously held back because every 5 feet is a cross truss. And it was in a checkerboard, so it was cross truss every 5 feet. So it couldn't. And then another issue is that if you notice that plane hit on an angle, about a 20-degree angle, and the right wing and its motor hit the next floor up, and the left wing and its motor hit the next floor down. So those took away, those destroyed any possibility of the plane. And then doing that, of course, it would tear apart the fuselage more by tearing apart the wings. See what I mean? So.
Okay, Wayne, does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you very much, Ronald, and thanks again. Okay, over.
Thank you, Wayne. Okay, I think Michael has another quick follow-up. Michael?
Yeah, I just want to say that the missing floor pans has been a big clue for a long time. We even have the governor of California, I'm sorry, New York, governor of New York on the site on video commenting on the lack of the floor pans. He's like, what happened to the floor pans? There's 220 acres of steel floor pans. I've installed these that hold the concrete until it sets up, until it cures. And the plane entering the building, I've long thought that they probably had explosives rigged. So, you know, just the bunker buster type technology that when the plane comes in, the explosives go off and it goes in. Otherwise, it probably would have crumpled and fell to the street.
Well, it went in, but it was demolished on the way in as it went in, you know, and then as it's a thin, empty shell, you wouldn't see it sticking out, and it wouldn't still couldn't reach the floor column. But then those floor pans, I didn't talk about the analysis of it, to turn those floor pans into little tiny pieces, you know, it had to in order to blow up, turn the concrete into powder, it had to turn those floor pans into tiny pieces. And it took more than 2 trillion pounds to tear up each one of those.
Yeah. I've been involved in demolitions. You take the saws and you cut a checkerboard and you use the jackhammers, you break it. It's a big, laborious process, a heck of a lot of energy. But I think that for the planes to enter the buildings the way they did, they had to have explosives time to go off. And interestingly, Donald Trump said the same thing on 9/11 when he was interviewed on television.
Well, he said he saw, I heard that, he heard explosions. He didn't say where or how, but he heard explosions. That's important, so it's more likely we're going to have some other thing. But I'd rather it go straight to the FBI, because we got a panel of people before that are not engineering scientists and not FBI agents, so it didn't get anywhere. And then in New York, they've tried twice. The last time was 10,000 petitioners went to the court, but those were petitioners asking for another hearing. It needs to go in for a criminal analysis, and then it gets this forensic analysis that I've done.
Okay, we're just about out of time here, but I think Xander had another quick question. It has to be very quick, Xander, so please make it very short. Go ahead.
Hey, just to make it short then, Doctor, would you be okay with some follow-up email correspondence?
Oh, yeah, go to, do you have my email?
It's I do not, but I can get it from Ken.
Yeah, Dr. Cutler's Gmail, Dr.
Okay, wonderful.
Cutler's at Gmail. And you can go to my book company website, Love from the Sea, in one word, lovefromthesea.com. Look under books in print. You'll see my list of books, including my dissertation and credentials.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, one moment, please. So we're going to need to go off of our Q&A. Okay, so did anybody have trouble getting on the stack that would like to ask a question? Good. Okay, so everyone had a chance. Dr. Cutmirth, we certainly want to warmly thank you for spending the time with us tonight to give us the skinny on your theory and the many details. And I want to thank also the questioners whose questions were very astute and to the point.
Those were good questions.
We appreciate it once again. You're welcome to stay for the rest of the teleconference, but in any case, we do thank you for spending the time with us tonight. And I'll send you the link for the recording of this if you want to,
I need the link. And there's things I had to skip because of the length of time, but I think we covered it pretty well.
Oh, yeah. I think
it's without a doubt I've proven that explosives had to be used. That's the plan. That's the main plan. And that's what I'll bring into federal court if needed. Okay?
Yes. And where are you at with respect to your legal effort? I mean, where does that stand?
Oh, I wrote it all up, and I have the evidence clear enough. Mm-hmm. But then I said, wait a minute, you know, even if it's clear enough, people still ask about what happened to the plane. You know, people on the street, they wonder, what happened to the plane? What did the plane do? Even though I proved that explosives destroyed the floors, they'd say, what happened to the plane? Well, so I did structural analysis, but
my question is, like, you haven't filed anything on your own. You're waiting for the FBI to act. Is that pretty much?
Oh no! I'm going to file a complaint with the FBI, and once my report is complete, I'm going to get registered professional mechanical engineers affidavits, and then we'll go to the FBI, and if they don't take up the case quickly, then I'll go into federal court on the basis. It's called misprision of treason. It's my duty.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So
yes.
That would be my angle. Okay.
Got it. Okay. Thank you once again for all this valuable information, Dr. Cupper.
It's my pleasure.
Ken?
Okay.
Ken?
Yeah, yes.
This is James, and I wondered if we could maybe engage Dr. Cupper in coming back after and reporting to us after his court case has terminated or reached a critical stage.
Sure, I can. Sure, I'll be happy to report it to all.
Sure.
Great.
I think we'd like to hear an update.
Okay.
It also occurs to me that the legal team from Justice in Focus might be interested in learning a little bit about Dr. Cutbert's legal effort, possibly helping to support it. But we should probably – too bad Barbara's not in the call here. But we'll have to get them in touch.
Tell them about what I'm doing and see what
we'll
they
do.
Think.
I will. I definitely shall. Okay. I'll make a commitment to that. Yep. Thanks again, Dr.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, well, that brings us to the next item on our agenda, which is our postponed item from last week. Wayne Costi will give us a brief presentation on Lloyd England, and the PDF accompanying his presentation can be linked, downloaded. It's on your draft agenda. There's a little link there under the draft agenda for this PDF, so you can follow along with the show. Wayne, go ahead.
Yes, Ken, can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great.
Hang on. I'm gonna put this into lecture mode, Wayne, so there won't be any background noise. So one moment.
Okay, great. So for those of you that don't have the agenda, you can get a copy of this presentation at hopeoutloud.org/Pentagon. Hopeoutloud.org/Pentagon. It's the top one, top item at the moment. So you can follow along there. There's a number of slides I want to go through. I got about 15 minutes to run through them. The reason I'm doing this is because it's the Lloyd England taxicab story has circulated around quite a bit. There seems to be a lot of misinformation, and in my review of the accident, the taxicab issue, I've seen very little discussion of the evidence. And so I wanted to just kind of go through what I have been able to find and share that with you. So if you go to slide two, we're going to we've got a table of context. We're going to give an overview of the accident scene. We're going to talk about the probable mechanics of the destruction of lampposts. We're going to document the parts of lamppost number two, then lamppost number one, and come up with some observations. And there's an appendix with some additional material. Again, slide three, the purpose is that the review of the taxicab incident is that when treated as an accident scene using the physics of motion, the location of the taxi and debris supports Lloyd's survivor fund statement. The location of most debris from light poles number one and two is documented in the photographic record. The location of the debris from light poles one and two is consistent with a high-speed impact of a flying thing called an airplane, I guess, at a point below the attachment point of the lamp support arms. That's what that's what I've observed, and I'll share that with you. So going to slide four, the text of Lloyd's Survivor Fund statement, which many of you are familiar with, is Lloyd, 69, began the morning of September 11th, 2001, like most days, driving his taxi cab. As he approached the Navy Annex, he saw a plane flying dangerously low overhead. Simultaneously, the plane struck a light pole, and the pole came crashing down onto the front of Lloyd's taxi cab, destroying the windshield in front of his eyes. Glass was everywhere as he tried to stop the car. Another car stopped, and the driver helped move the heavy pole off Lloyd's car. As they were moving the pole, they heard a big boom and turned to see an explosion. The light pole fell on Lloyd, and he struggled to get up underneath, wondering what had happened. The reason I've highlighted the big boom is some of the people who described the Lloyd incident claim that that explosion is actually the plane hitting the building a second and a half later, and they say it couldn't have happened because you can't have anyone get out of the car, try to pull out a pole in the second and a half it takes. So, but what they forget is, and we'll touch on that in a little bit here, is that there was another large explosion 4 to 6 minutes later. So if you go to slide five, the windshield and the rear seat are damaged by the light pole. Many people have seen the slide on page five, which is the windshield damage. Slides six and seven are small holes in the rear seat of the fabric. Significant holes, but not anything really huge. So going into slide eight, we have a depiction of Lloyd's taxicab with a pole. The top is what they call the doodle by Lloyd England himself, showing that the pole was sticking out over the hood a little bit. And interestingly enough, it's got a little knob on the top, and that looks we'll talk about that a little bit later. Depiction by another person, I don't know who it was, has the mast pole sticking out of his light, out of the taxi cab with a bend in it, and it looks like Pinocchio's nose, but it's not at all like any of the pictures of the evidence. So going into slide nine, we have the Darrell Donnelly explosion captured 4 to 6 minutes after impact. Darrell reports that this did sound like an explosion. So 4 to 6 minutes for someone to stop, try to pull a pole out of the windshield is consistent with the Darrell Donnelly recorded explosion. So slide 11 gets into the nomenclature of the lamp pole parts. This is taken from a Jason Ingersoll photo on 9/11. You can see that there's the mast, which is the upright. We've got a lower arm and an upper arm. Lower arm is mostly straight for most of the length, and you can see that there is, in fact, at the very tip, there is a connector to the upper arm, and that is remarkably like the dimple that we saw on Lloyd's doodle. Going on to slide 12, if you want to take a look at stopping and reaction times, you see at 40 miles an hour, the stopping distance with reaction time is about 164 feet from standard tables, including reaction times. So if we take a look at I've got three slides here. They're all on the same scale. These are the hypothesized locations of the impacts on light lamp post number one, lamp post number two on the left-hand side. Going on to slide 14, what we have are a couple of the pieces of the poles shown in red. The blue squares are the taxi cab where it was stopped. At the bottom, and going up 160 feet, the nominal stopping distance is where the light the taxi cab would have been if he were to be trying to stop at standard stopping speeds and distances for about 40 miles an hour. And that would mean that it would be just to the a little bit upstream, shall we say, of where the light post lamppost could have been. So what we're hypothesizing here is that the locations were right for something to have been hit the lamppost number two, the dot on the left and the upper left side, and parts of it to have hit his car, and then for him to have stopped in 160 feet. Slide 15, again, same scale. We're going to zoom in on these a little bit, show the locations. We've got the mast and the upper arm and lamp 2. We'll just kind of go through these on the next slides that are zoomed in a little bit more. Slide 16 is just a zoomed in portion. I guess I've already said everything that needs to be done. We've got the 80 feet of reaction time and 80 feet of braking time at 40 miles an hour to get from where he started to where he's from where he stopped. We know that for sure, and where he probably started with a pole in his windshield, flying glass, and all that other stuff. Slide 17 documents the locations, and we're going to see pictures of these, of most of these are, of all the things I've laid out here. We've got mast 2, we've got the pole, we've got the upper arm and lamp 2, and then the lowest part, we have the upper and lower arm and lamp 1 below. We've got the large curved piece, and then there's parts of mast 1 in the travel lane. The left-hand travel lane or near it. Slide 19 is going to talk about the probable mechanics of the destruction of the light poles. Again, I've seen very little discussion of anything related to the physics, so just a lot of going back and forth about I believe them, I don't believe them. But if you actually look at the evidence as I've done here and go through it, it looks pretty realistic that we have the poles being severed at impact at mid mast height. The mast is very quickly severed. It's a light gauge aluminum. I wouldn't want to drive my car into it, but it can be severed. The support arms and lamps have little horizontal acceleration due to their inertia, and they fall near their original location once it's been severed. The middle 5 feet of mast number 1 suggests the impact by a kind of a large mast, probably the leading wing spar, and is actually severed and goes much further. Slide 20 shows the sequence of an impact. There's an initial impact where it's severed at about, showing here, about 22 feet off the ground. The top parts kind of rotate around, and this is for mast number 1, because you can see that there's about a 5-foot section that is continuing to go and travel downward, and will end up, we'll see that in the near the left travel lane. Slide 22, we're going to start about talking about lamppost number 2. The mast appears to be bent at a 90 degrees, not severed. The mast is found laying to the left of the flight path, suggesting to me that the mast was hit by a much weaker part of the wing. The lamp and the upper support arm appear to be on the fog line, shoulder of Route 27, landed near the base of lamppost number 2. Approximately under their original location. You can't place it exactly with a photo, but it's pretty close. And the lower support arm, the one thing that isn't well-documented or clearly documented is the lower support arm for mast number 2. Slide 23 shows the mast of lamppost number 2 is visible from a distance. Slide 24, we're going to zoom in on it. You can see it's bent, laying down on the side. Slide 25 is a photo by Courtney Platt. And you can see the fog line, and this image has a picture of that Courtney took. It shows the upper arm of the lamp post and the lamp mat, the lamp head itself, and with the Pentagon burning in the distance. And the image on the right shows about where this is located, and it's right at the base of, just a little bit away from the base of where the lamp post mast number two would have been connected to the base, to the concrete footing. So now we're going to go look at lamppost number one. Here the mast was severed into three parts. Mast one is the large segment, the lower 25 feet or so, seen in the right travel lane. Mast two, part two, is the middle 5-foot segment, seen near the left travel lane. Mast part number three is a top, about a 1-foot segment. It's still connected to the upper support arms and initially seen on the travel line, in the travel lane of the fog line. On the travel lane side of the fog line. It's going to be moved in some of the later photos. Upper and lower support arms are still together in these images here. So slide 28 is the mast parts one and two for lamppost number one, and you can see mast part number two is near the travel lane. There were cars traveling in that lane immediately after the impact. It was clear, relatively clear. When you take a look at the other images here, we see the mast part one on the right hand side extending in front of the car, and then there's a lamp or something else that is pointed out. I'm not quite sure what that is. It doesn't seem to be either the lamp itself or anything else. I'm not sure what it is, but moving on to slide 29, this is a Jason Ingersoll photo. It's taken with a telephoto lens, so things are a little, this perspective is a bit challenged here, but you can see the curve of the lamppost as it was bent, and you can see in the background, we'll zoom in on those, the upper and lower lamp support arms. And let's kind of zoom in to slide 30. You can now clearly see the upper part of the mast is shown there, mast part three, and still connected to the one of the lamp support arms. The lamp head is, I believe, to the left of that under the labeling there. For mast three, slide 31. Yeah, it's just a zoom in of that zoom in, and you can see the things more clearly. You can actually see the wires hanging out of the coming out of the lamp post. I don't know which arm it would have come out of. Probably the upper one, but you can see it a lot of some detail. Wish there was more, but that's what we have. Slide 32 is just it's a different photo. This one now has a mystery piece in it. We don't know what it is. We don't think it's either of the two lamp, the upper or lower lamp arms, because the part three of mast one has been moved to the curb side of the fog line. The mystery piece could be either the lower arm of light post number two, the one that was not photographed in the debris that we saw a few slides earlier. And of course you can see mast part two of mast one near the left travel lane again. So what we have for observations is on slide 34, most of the parts of the lamp posts one and two are accounted for in photos. Both the lamp post masts are seen. The mast one is in three parts. Mast two is in one piece. It's bent at 90 degrees. Both upper support arms are accounted for. Both one lower support arm for lamppost one is seen. The lower support arm for lamppost two is missing and probably is what impaled Lloyd's taxicab. And so that's what I have. There's appendices that give a full text of Lloyd's survivor son's story. One of the witnesses that saw the light poles being hit. So
I guess I can open it for questions now.
Okay. Let's go into Q&A mode here. 1 second. So if you want to ask a question or make a comment, star 6, and it'll put you into the queue. Star 6, if you want to ask a question or make a comment. And Xander, you're first.
Hey, Wayne. Appreciate this as always. I have a question on slide 29. Slide 29, I'm looking at a light pole base with 4 anchoring bolts. This is where the light pole is affixed to its concrete footing. And the pole has this really substantial curve in it. And then there's torn metal at the end of that. In your earlier slide, you'd speculated that a wing or some other object had severed the pole midway and that it had broken into 3 discrete pieces. And I'm wondering how you explain this curvature in this lower portion of the lamp. That's one question. And then the second is on slide 31, you're calling what looks to be 2 wires, a lower arm of lamppost and an upper arm of lamppost, but they really look like just electrical wires, so I was wondering if you could maybe explain that slide a little bit more. Thanks.
Well, first of all, the reason I pointed out that the perspectives are a problem with the Jason Ingersoll photo is it appears to have been taken with a telephoto lens. And any little bit of curve kind of shows up and it looks amplified at that low angle. If you look at some of the other photos, and I'm trying to come up with some that I've included here, you'll see that it's not nearly as dramatic when seen from a different angle. So, for example, on slide 28, it looks a lot less bent than it does in that Jason Ingersoll photo. I pondered that, and my answer to that is that it is just a function of the telephoto lens kind of amplifying, kind of compressing the curve. So I'm not sure that I recall specifically what you wanted to know about the others. So could you repeat the question?
Yeah, slide 30. It says mask part 3. And, okay, I maybe see why you're calling that part 3. Slide 31 has me a bit confused. I see top of mask and then lower arm of lamppost. And well, I just can't agree that what we're looking at are lower arms of the lamppost based on the diameter of it, the clear, like, sheathing material around an electrical wire. And these look like the wires that run within the lamp. I don't see how those – are you thinking that those are metal armatures?
Yeah, it's my supposition, I guess you have to say, since I don't have these things in hand. But it's my supposition that these are, in fact, lamp support arms, and that what you're actually looking at is the top of the mast attached to something. These are approximately the right length to be the support arms. They're badly mangled or straightened out or whatever you want to call it. They do seem to be attached. You know, again, the photographic record is not complete, of course, but I think this is the best description of what we're observing here. Okay? Anything else? Oh, you had another question, I think, another part.
No, that's it for now.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Okay, let's see. Anybody else have a question on this queue there?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm down for a question. Ken, do you have me or?
No, because you're a host, so you just have to ask the question.
Okay, is it my turn or is it someone else?
Yes, it's your turn. There's somebody else on the queue that I can see.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Well, first of all, I have to throw out the comment that I think, Wayne, that you're going to incredible lengths to try to make this part of the 9/11 story, which is one of the most unbelievable parts of certainly the Pentagon story. You seem to be twisting yourself into knots to try to make it seem possible that this could have happened. And I want to, there's a few details that I have to bring up from your presentation. First of all, you refer to the Survivors Fund account, and right in the account, it doesn't match the physical evidence. There's a quote in there where he says that the plane struck a light pole and the pole came crashing down onto the front of Lloyd's taxi cab. Well, you know, we know it didn't come crashing down onto the car because there's not even a scratch on the hood. So I want to make that point. Also, you have the diagram from one person's depiction of the pole sticking out of the front of the car. Well, that person wasn't a witness. So that's just a diagram of what might have happened. Nobody saw that. In fact, nobody saw the pole hit the cab at all, and no one saw Lloyd and his silent stranger friend who stopped and supposedly helped him pull the pole out of the car. No one saw this. I also want to mention that on slide 29, you've got the one with the perspective or the telephoto perspective. If you look at other photos of that, you're quite right. It is an exaggerated curvature that you see in the pole. But in fact, the pole is curved in other photos as well. It's just more of a gradual curve. So I think that's still unexplained. And also there's a scratch that goes across the road on slide 29. And I pointed that out in our debate back last year. That appears to match up with the end of the pole. It appears that the pole has been dragged across the road and placed where it is. Perhaps you might want to comment on that. But the most important one I wanted to, and I know I'm throwing a lot of stuff at you here, but the last one, I guess I'll first of all, there's the backseat hole. You referred to it as significant, but not huge. I don't know how you can call that significant. I don't even know if, I think if you put your fist through that hole, it would make it bigger than it is now. So how does that constitute a significant hole? I don't understand. But in terms of the physics, I forget which slide it is. You have the right wing of the plane, which is swept back from perpendicular to the fuselage. You have that making contact with the pole, and yet somehow the pole goes not to the right where you would think it would go, but it goes forward somehow above or below or somehow the fuselage to go up the road, straight up the road, and into Lloyd's cab. I don't see how the physics of that work out at all. So I'll leave it there, and you can comment on any of that stuff you want.
I'll go through what I can. You know, first of all, you mentioned the Survivors Fund. It was not a legal deposition. It was a Survivor Fund statement. And that is what he said at the time, and it is largely consistent with the evidence, right? And your critique of him saying that with the critique of the pole landing on the hood or in the windshield. Now, what we have, the reason I showed the Jason Ingersoll's photos of the lamp post, it was just one of the pictures in front of the Pentagon that was pretty much a side view, was that you can see that there are three things that can be called poles. No one took the engineering description of what he meant by when he said a pole. There is the mast, and I've used the word mast to talk about the large pole that many people seem to say landed on his hood. There are also two other things that are long, very long, slender things that in other circumstances, people would call poles. I call them the upper lamp support arm and the lower lamp support arm to distinguish them, because otherwise we call them poles, that all three things would be poles. We'd be so confused, I couldn't describe them. So I was very careful. Hopefully I didn't make any errors in the presentation talking about these three things called poles. The objection that the pole landed on his hood or in his windshield doesn't necessarily, you can say that the plane hit a pole, the big mast, and another pole piece of the thing landed in my windshield. The word pole is still the appropriate word.
But we know that didn't happen, though, Wayne. We know that didn't happen because Lloyd said it didn't happen. He said it was the long part of the pole. Sorry to interrupt you, but
we're gonna hang in a second. So
okay.
we can come back to that if you like. Now, the gradual curve is explainable, and I thought that the depictions that I came up with to describe the bends in slide 20 are mechanically correct. Not perfect, but they're mechanically correct. You know, I don't have great Photoshop capabilities here. This is the best I could do with PowerPoint and whatever it is I can work with. But that is a description of the plane hitting at midpoint, bending the pole, the lower part. The upper part is more severed. It separates at the upper reaches of the lamppost, and then the top parts fall down. The middle 5-foot section continues. So I think the curve is well explained by going and looking at those posts. Now, the curve scratch line on the pavement, of course, people have pointed that out. I don't see any great significance to it. If this is in fact such a highly staged event, the pole probably, just making this up like everyone else does, maybe they would have dragged it from where it was standing into the lane instead of from way over the wherever it was back. The drag line is going in the wrong direction if you have to focus on that. Now, I said that the hole in the back seat is significant. Well, it's because it's a hole. It's not a huge hole. It's not, it is what it is. When Craig went with Lloyd and they reviewed this thing, that's what they commented. Oh, it's a hole. It's a small hole. How could a 20-foot pole, six inches in diameter thing made such a tiny hole? Well, how about if it was the lower arm of the lower lamp support arm of lamp post number two? I mean, that seems to be quite consistent with that. Now, I think you also had Lloyd actually saying that it was a lower, larger piece. I'm afraid that if you actually look at the CIT interviews in the places where he's pointing at the pole, he does not say that. He says, no, that's not it. And then there's all this blah, 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 and then move on to something else. Never in any of those CIT interviews does Craig ever say, well, how far was it sticking out? You never see any of that. All you see where he talks about the length of the pole is that in that living room scene, it's the only one I know of. It's the only one I've transcribed, paid enough attention to transcribe it. He has clearly never said that light pole was it. You have Craig saying, oh, that's the pole that hit you. And then he gets confused, doesn't know what he's going on, that's when he turns and becomes very uncooperative. I mean, if you want to go through the text of what he says, I'll be glad to set aside another conversation here on the monthly conference call or someplace else. But if you actually listen to what they said in those interviews, he's not talking about that large piece. That's Craig saying, that's it, and Lloyd is either mumbling or saying, no, it's not. So do you have anything else you want to ask?
Well, I would just say that I don't want to take up more than my time here, but I think he very directly says it's the long part of the pole. And I will, before the next call, I will dig out an exact quote of that, and we can see if we want to discuss it again next time or whatever. But I believe he did very specifically say it was the long part of the pole. But,
well,
you know,
okay.
That,
well, maybe we'll have to wait until one of you finds some more positive quote from Lloyd that we can use for reference. Is that a thing, Craig?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
fine.
So I think there are no more callers. Let me just take it off of. Come on. Sorry. My web is being uncooperative. Oh, there we go. Okay. Right, so we're going to take it off of Q&A mode. Did anyone not get a chance to ask a question because of technical difficulties that would like to ask a question? All right, good. Well, thank you, Wayne, for a very comprehensive presentation. And I guess there might be some follow-up, depending on what you and Craig can come up with in the meantime. But appreciate it very much, okay? And that takes us to our announcement section. And our first major announcement, of course, is that next month we will have an additional teleconference. Yes, on the 18th of January, the long-awaited third in our series of Pentagon debates between Craig McKee and Barbara Honegger will be held formally right here at the same time. So that would be January the 18th, and we will be sending out an advanced draft agenda the weekend before to remind everybody about that, and then we'll have our normal teleconference at the end of the month. Okay, so now if anybody has any announcements, this is a good time for it. Craig would like to make a quick announcement before we get started. Craig?
Yeah, thanks. I just wanted to maybe institute a new procedure for us, a little bit new, I guess. One thing I found is when I do the minutes that the announcements very often are very hard to, you know, I have to really put a lot of work into kind of summarizing them and really making sure I've heard all the names, and because sometimes they're not simple announcements, but they're kind of descriptions of a whole situation. So I think what would make a lot more sense is if the person making the announcement, I mean, people can listen to the recordings, of course, after, but if somebody wants the announcement to be in the minutes, and I'm going to make a real effort to get those minutes out earlier so that they're of use to people for announcements. But if somebody wants their announcement to be in the minutes, if they could send me like a sentence or two sentence summary of what it is so that I can just put it in, because the person making the announcement just understands the content much better than I do, and it would save me tons of time. So I will give everybody and I'll remind everybody on the next call, my email address. It's CraigMcKee911, that shouldn't be hard to remember, @gmail.com. So if anybody makes an announcement and they would like to see it appear in the minutes, just send me a quick email with just the details of, you know, just a very short summary, if that's okay with everybody.
Okay, so if you want your announcement in the minutes, you'll need to send Craig a brief summary of it so that he can transcribe it to the minutes. So he doesn't have to. He shouldn't be needing to do research on the side here on this. So that's the deal. And who has an announcement that they would like to share with the community? Anybody?
So, yeah, this is Wayne.
Wayne, go ahead.
Yeah. So. I just want to let you know that the 9/11 Truth Action Project is going to be trying to lead a 9/11 outreach at the presidential inauguration on January 20th, the date of the inauguration, and the 21st. We hope to have a presence there also, because on the 21st, on Saturday the 21st, is going to be a lot of rallies. We're doing a 9/11 truth outreach activities. We're not promoting pro or against. We're just trying to make sure that people are aware of the message. I think there is some people are receptive to it, and so that's what we're trying to do. There's an article on the 911tap.org website called 9/11 Truth Action Project at the presidential inauguration. Give you some details there. So I think that's all. Thanks, over.
Okay. All right. Any other announcements? Well, if there aren't, then I guess we'll call it quits for tonight and look forward to seeing you all on the 18th.
and then again on the last Wednesday of January. So Happy New Year, everyone, and have a good evening. Good night.
Happy New Year. Okay.
Happy New Year, guys.
Ken and everyone else.
Hey, Ken?